You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show,
the Peshmerga, which roughly translates to those who confront death, are a force spawned from decades of Kurdish resistance to Turkish and Iraqi dominance. Well-trained and nationalistic, the force fought competently against these nations' armies.
From northern Iraq to eastern Ukraine, we'll discuss today's top stories with Sky News' Tim Marshall and Ivor Gaber from City University. Also coming up...
So no love, spared that, no love such as normally vented on the speechless infant in the home, no. Nor indeed, for that matter, any of any kind, no love of any kind at any subsequent stage. It's a typical affair, nothing of any note till coming up to 60 when, what, 70, good God.
I hope you are concentrating because actress Lisa Dwan will be here to explain the challenges of playing one of the most difficult roles in theatre. All that, plus a music review from Billboard's Gary Trust and a check-in with our correspondent in Mali. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, starting right now. So lots to get through here in the next hour on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The International Committee of the Red Cross said today it was waiting for clarification from Russia of what was loaded onto a convoy of trucks from Russia heading towards Ukraine. Russia says the convoy is carrying tons of humanitarian aid needed for eastern Ukraine, where government forces are closing in on pro-Russian rebels, but Kiev said it would not allow the vehicles to cross onto its territory, and NATO has warned that Russia could use the humanitarian operation as a pretext for an invasion. Well, Robert Fox, defence correspondent for London's Evening Standard newspaper, said that was a credible claim.
NATO conjecture, I think, is absolutely fair, and I can just sketch you the scenario that they'll put in the humanitarian, they will probably kick out the International Red Cross observers and say, look, it's far, far worse than we ever imagined, so we're going in.
Israel says there's been little progress so far in talks to try to end the conflict in Gaza. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators are resuming separate talks in Egypt as the 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza holds for a second day. It's believed there's still a significant gap between the two sides. A Spanish priest who died after contracting the Ebola virus in Liberia has now been cremated in Spain, the first European death in the outbreak that's already claimed more than 1,000 lives. Liberia is to receive an experimental, untested drug to treat some people with Ebola. It's already been used on two US aid workers who've since shown signs of improvement. In Nigeria, consultant virologist Professor Sunday Omilabu said they're doing all they can to contain the spread of the disease.
As we are moving gradually, at least we know we are getting upper hand. So we, based on what we have now, we know those that have exposures and we are monitoring their contacts too. Those are the secondary contacts.
The Vatican has called on Muslim religious leaders to condemn what it called unspeakable criminal acts by Islamic State militants who have taken a series of cities in northern Iraq, forcing tens of thousands of Christians and Yazidis to flee their homes. The news comes as Haider al-Abadi was named by the Iraqi president as Iraq's new prime minister delegate. And I should say designate. The lead FARC guerrilla negotiator, Ivan Marquez, has slammed the Colombian government's application of legal frameworks to the peace process on Tuesday, saying that they created obstacles to peace and not solutions. Speaking at a news conference in Havana, he complained that the law was being twisted to benefit one side at the other side's expense. And the US Secretary of State John Kerry has today praised the late comedian Robin Williams, calling him an absolute genius with an extraordinary zest for his profession. Williams was found dead on Monday from an apparent suicide at his home near San Francisco. He was 63. He won an Oscar for his role in the film Good Will Hunting. Well, Jim Dunn was one of Robin Williams' first drama teachers.
He was just a very sharp human being. He was just an ordinary guy. He was just Robin. Everybody loved him. He was nice, he was polite, he was giving.
And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House right here on Monocle 24, and we're going to be right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres,
Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. This is Monaco 24.
Ot Londo, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. And the time here in London now is 18.05, which means it's 13.05 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news is Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor for Sky News, and Ivor Gaber, the director of City University's Masters in Political Journalism. Welcome both to the programme. Now, let's start today's discussion in Iraq, where the country's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was effectively deposed and replaced overnight. John Kerry today said that Barack Obama and US Vice President Joe Biden have congratulated Haider al-Abadi on his nomination as Prime Minister and urged him to form a new cabinet quickly. The US would, he announced, fully support a new and inclusive Iraqi government. Meanwhile, al-Maliki said that al-Abadi's appointment has no value whatsoever. Everything that happened today is meaningless. Let's start with you, Tim. What seems to have unfolded is that despite what Nouri al-Maliki has been saying, he doesn't seem to have much choice in the matter. Even the Iranians have congratulated the new man on his appointment.
He does have the Special Anti-Terrorist Brigade. He may have the 6th Division. He may have the 11th Division. He may have the 16th Armored Division. All of which are controlled by the Chief of Staff of the Army. And who is the Chief of Staff of the Army? Maliki's son. It's not a done deal. And it's an extraordinarily dangerous moment because I agree with you, on the surface, it looks like he's being deposed. But if he is in control of the army and his son controls the army and X of them stand by him and the units that have deployed around the key areas have been seen to be waving three fingers in the air, which means a third term for Maliki. So it's not over yet and it couldn't happen at a worse time because Islamic State knows that if the what is left of the Iraqi army starts to fight itself, then nobody can fight ISIS. And so there's constraints about having a coup d'etat and there's constraints about the army taking on each other. It is a terribly dangerous moment.
A terribly dangerous moment, Tim. But just before we bring in Ivor, isn't it strange then he hasn't already kind of done some of that manoeuvring today? Well, because the agenda seems to have, even though, in these instances, it's minutes often seem to matter. And the agenda seems to have moved away from him a little bit during the day.
No, I agree with you. I mean, you can see power falling away from him. And you're right, the Iranians are ready to ditch him. The Americans have effectively ditched him. But he does have his own internal power base. And there are elements in the Dawa party. The Dawa is a very large coalition party. Dawa means outreach, call. And they have lots and lots of elements within Dawa. And there are many elements within Dawa that still answer to him because that's where their patronage is. Because if he falls, they fall. And that's what I mean about it being such a dangerous moment. I mean, I'm not saying there's going to be an internal civil war within the military. It's just that we are at that juncture now where decisions have to be made, phone calls have to be made. People have to say, yes, I will back you or no, I won't back you. There's the Badr brigades. The Badr brigades did not sign up to when the president named the new prime minister, the Badr brigades, who were also represented in parliament, did not sign up to it. And they are a Shia militia. And there are other brigades. So I'm just saying that we're at the juncture where it's a critical moment where if you ring up, sometimes people just don't answer the phone. You know, the power drains away. But if they are going to answer the phone, they're going to say, I'm going to back you. What I'm saying is it's a critical moment and it's directly connected to the fight against Islamic State.
Ivor, you wanted to jump in, but I just wonder whether the one kind of potential for, this is a terrible, terrible, complicated situation to play out over the coming days. But maybe one of the slight hopes is that I imagine that many of the people around al-Maliki know that if they want to hold Iraq together in any sense, they need to start answering what the US has been saying, ditch your man.
Well, I'm sure there's an element of truth in it. And certainly, as Tim says, with US and Iran withdrawing their support, it looks to me that his position is untenable. However, I wanted to pick up something I defer to Tim's expert and intricate knowledge of the Iraqi militia and in particular the Shiite militia. But I was just wondering, and forgive me asking a question, I know it's your job, but
please have
the humiliation, the humiliation that the Iraqi, the essentially Shiite army, suffered by the complete collapse. Collapse isn't even the right word. Running away, handing over their weapons. Surely that has fatally undermined their standing even within the Shiite community.
It has. But that still doesn't mean that it won't. Well, in fact, that's all the more reason why it might splinter. Because if they haven't even got that pride in the army, which even under Saddam was one of the few things that everyone actually agreed on, we all like the army, then it becomes even more dangerous. Look, I think we all agree that power is sliding away from Maliki. It's just that it hasn't slid away yet. And until it does, he has still got an awful lot of men with an awful lot of weapons. They are the best trained, the best equipped. They've got tanks out on the streets already. It's not over yet. I don't think he'll win it. I think enough people will do the right thing and say time's up. You know, they'll tap on the shoulder. But if they don't, then at that point, you were kind enough to invite me on a couple of weeks ago, and I remember we were talking. I said it was the end of Christianity in Iraq. Like, we may be looking at the end of days of Iraq now. This could be the end of Iraq as a unitary state.
Of course, it's not an ancient state, is it? I mean, no. Iraq itself is a relatively modern invention.
The Turks ruled it in three areas, and it's now separating back into those three areas.
Tim, on the question of Al-Abadi, he seems to be a somewhat more modest man than Maliki, but whether he has the ability, as you say, to kind of hold the country together is the nervous thing. And if he doesn't have effective control over many of the military groups, the key question here is, can anything be done to stop IS and to stop IS kind of charging across the country? Do you think he has any hope of, getting a united front sorted over the coming days?
Yes. And if he does, then a new government with a prime minister that some of the Sunni tribal leaders will agree, okay, it's not going to be as bad as it was. Consequently, they won't help Islamic State as much. Crucially, then, because under Maliki, he would not send all the best weapons up to the Peshmerga. The Americans sent all the weapons in for the Iraqi army, and they said, we're having the lot. The Kurds aren't getting any. And now we're seeing that they're outgunned. So the new prime minister might say, yeah, we're going to get that stuff up to the Kurds. Too sweet. And the Americans will be arming the Kurds. They will hold the line. I do think that the line can be held. After that, who knows?
Ivor, when you look at what's unfolding here, the charge of IS, as we're saying, through the country, there doesn't seem to be, but there hasn't been a united front. It's a very difficult enemy to kind of, for the US to kind of, bomb, because, they're a ground force and almost like a guerrilla force. What do you think the outside world should do? Because, yes, it's great to say that we'll come now in with some military power. And in many instances, we can say that, the outside forces were responsible for the mess that this country has got in, undoubtedly. But does that mean that they can do anything now to help?
Well, to use a famous political cliche, we are where we are. We all have our own opinions as to how we got into this mess, as that great political philosopher Oliver Laurel said to Stan Hardy, or the other way around, fine mess you got me into. And I think we in the West have done that. However, we are where we are. I would argue with you that they're a guerrilla force. I think to a large extent, and I have to say I'm judging this on the television pictures I've seen, they tend to be operating as an army, a guerrilla. They're not operating within urban areas, undermining. They're actually moving in with military.
Islamic
force.
State.
Yes.
They have graduated to become an army.
So they're easier to bomb. That's what I'm saying. They're easier to bomb. Not that bombing urban guerrillas has ever stopped people. But nonetheless, I do think where we are, I mean, I have to say, I find it very difficult to find arguments against Western military involvement, not on the ground, but in the air and in supplying arms. I'm not a great gung-ho, let's get involved, but this seems to me a matter of extreme urgency.
Tim, no reason not to get involved, but let's just look at all the instances, and we don't need to broaden the argument too much, but, we meddled in Syria, we meddled in Egypt, we meddled in Libya, we meddled in Iraq. Every one of those countries is worse off after the meddling, surely.
Well, that's a pejorative word, meddling. I can't have an opinion one way or the other. There was certainly action. Sometimes not doing anything is an option. Obama appears to have been taking that for the past 4 or 5 years. I don't think you can argue against the last bit of your sentence, that it is inarguably much worse everywhere than it was. And
but in the instance of Iraq, surely people's daily lives, they were terrifying often under Saddam Hussein.
They were.
But you know, there was an opportunity for, you know, people who are non-Muslims to live there, you know, for women to go to work, for families to go on holiday even. All those things have vanished.
I'm afraid that the great theory which the left of centre intellectuals in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s held has been proved to be wrong, which was that the right of centre theory, which was that these strong men, these dictators, held the lid on a boiling pot. And if you took that lid off, if you got rid of those dictators, the pot would explode. I'm afraid that that second part of the argument is the one that has come to pass, and I think has been shown to be true, that various cultures and societies are in different cycles of development, political development, and some are not ready for open, free societies through not necessarily any fault of their own. But going in, is this the topic to go in or not to go in? The Americans can do this by themselves. If the British get involved, it is only to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Atlantic ally. The Americans don't need the British. They need them for what's called top cover, political cover. The British have sent two tornadoes. It's a signal. It's messaging. They've just sent two tornadoes. It doesn't make any difference. That's a political act, not a military act.
Now, let's turn now to northern Iraq, where Kurdish forces in the region continue their push against the fighters from the Islamic State. The US has apparently been supplying Kurdish military forces with weapons to bolster its defences. Monocle's Rebecca Collard has this short report.
On the streets of Kurdistan, faith in the Kurdish fighters is strong and almost unanimous. Kurds believe in the might of their Peshmerga forces, a 100,000-strong army with a mandate to protect the Kurdish semi-autonomous region of northern Iraq. When the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria took over swaths of northern Iraq in June, the Iraqi army simply fled, dropping their weapons and tossing their uniforms into the desert. But the Kurdish forces stood strong, holding a 1,000-kilometer border with the radical Sunni militants. The Peshmerga, which roughly translates to those who confront death, are a force spawned from decades of Kurdish resistance to Turkish and Iraqi dominance. Well-trained and nationalistic, the force fought competently against these nations' armies. But to the shock of many military and political analysts, the Peshmerga were pushed from several key villages by ISIS militants in recent weeks. Some speculate that the problem is the Kurds' limited artillery and military hardware, which is now facing off against American-made weapons ISIS looted as Iraqi troops fled their posts. There are now rumors that the U.S. will be supplying the Kurds with new weapons to help them defend their territory and fight ISIS. But others say this is simply not the mighty Peshmerga of 40 years ago. The last decade has seen relative prosperity and security in the Kurdish region, and the Peshmerga haven't fought a proper war in two decades. The force was once composed of dedicated mountain men raised on guns and nationalism. Now the Kurdish territory has more malls than military bases. And some say the Kurdish government has become too relaxed about security as they focus on economic development. While the U.S. weapons and airstrikes will assist the Kurdish fighters, many say America's role needs to be political also, to pressure Baghdad to form a new, more inclusive government and bring Sunnis and Kurds back into the fold.
Well, that was Monocle's correspondent Rebecca Collard there, touching on some of the points we've already been dwelling on at the beginning of the show. Tim, why have the Peshmerga been such a disaster?
Oh, I think that's a bit harsh. No, really.
Okay. Why have they been ineffective at stopping?
Forgive
me. As you say, a group of people who, until not long ago, were barely, you know, they've only formed an army in recent months. Suddenly, they're charging. They're 30 kilometers from the gates of Erbil.
Indeed, they have been ineffective. We can agree for several reasons. As we touched on, the Iraqi government has not sent up weapons so that the Peshmerga forces, which you could argue compromise part of the overall Iraqi armed forces, are well equipped. They're not well equipped. They have a very small amount of artillery. They have, they've got machine guns and rifles, but that's not much good against artillery and the stuff that ISIS have got. Secondly, ISIS are fighting at the moment to their strengths, Islamic State, I should say. They have, they're called technicals. They're pickup trucks where you can, about 15 fighters. If you've got 40 pickup trucks, each with 15 fighters, and they all storm into a town, that's a lot of fighters storming into a town very quickly, and they very quickly take it over. They are also extremely well motivated, fighting in areas which are Sunni Arab Muslim, and where some of the population have actually greeted them as liberators, saying we've had enough of the Shia-led government in Baghdad. The moment they're going to move outside and into Kurdish areas, you will see the situation change rapidly, because then the Kurds are fighting in their own geographic space, which they understand and know, and it's more hilly, it's not flat. Secondly, they are fighting for their own country. And thirdly, they're going to get every single weapon they ask for, bar the nuclear bomb, from America over the next few weeks.
Ivor, we've already seen that the US is, you know, is beginning, it seems, to supply the arms that the Kurds need. Do you think that's the right move?
I think it's the only move at this stage. I mean, the Kurds should have been better armed by the government in Baghdad as part of the general supply of weapons that the US have been making over the last few years. And that's one of the big reasons why they're so resentful. I have to say, by the way, that Kurdish spokespeople I've listened to have not been actually overwhelmingly enthusiastic about al-Abadi, who they blame for their economic mess, because he was an economics, one of the...
Yeah, and he's ministers. A Kurd, yeah, the president.
I think that it's not even a done deal that if Malachi is replaced in Baghdad, that the Kurds will be dancing in the streets. However, coming back to the key issue, it's difficult, given the current state of play, to see that the US has any alternative but to supply the Kurds with weapons. But, of course, that opens another can of worms, because Kurds aren't just in Iraq. Kurds are in Syria. Kurds are in Turkey,
Iran.
Okay. And there's no guarantee that those weapons, American-supplied weapons, don't find their ways into these other countries.
Because the moment of Kurdistan is upon us. This is a historical moment, and they have seized it partially in Iraq to create what is effectively a Kurdistan. But the greater Kurdistan takes in the countries our honourable friend mentions. And so what's to say those weapons won't be used for that? I don't think they will be. Briefly,
but they're still a bit dependent on this firepower coming up from Baghdad, aren't they?
Well, I think they're going to get it most of it from the Americans.
Right.
But firstly, one of the reasons that Baghdad didn't give the Kurds weapons is because the Kurds were busy selling Iraqi oil that happened to be in their area direct to the Turks and not giving the money down to Baghdad. That will continue. They are effectively out there on their own now. And I think there will be strings attached. You don't use these weapons to press into Turkey. Some of them might come through Turkey. The American weapons might come through. You can get them into Incirlik Air Base in Turkey and then drive them up. But you know, you do not use them to then turn it round and try to create a Kurdistan out of parts of the Middle East.
I've got to ask you something a little bit contentious. You know, that, you know, obviously what's sprung us into action is what's been happening to, you know, the Yazidi refugees, Christians. And as Tim says, you know, that he came in here a few weeks ago and spoke about the risk that Iraq would no longer be a Christian country. You know, the Islamic State have been doing their business for a long, long time without any kind of response. Do you think it took this kind of, you know, these pictures of Christians being forced from their home to actually marshal enough public support to do something? I wonder why the US didn't do something, as you say, it's been going on for some time. Why didn't they do something some weeks ago? Did it oddly need a good Christian narrative to kind of galvanize? I know, contentious, but I wonder why it suddenly happens at this point.
Well, I'd roll the time scale back a bit, because it seems to me the difficulties for the Americans in confronting the Islamic State or ISIS was that had they done that, let's say 2 months ago, they would have been intervening on the side of Assad in Syria. They were damned if they do and damned if they don't, in one sense. Clearly, they have failed to support sufficiently the secular opposition to Assad. So were they better off letting ISIS get on with opposing the Syrian army or what? I mean, I do think it was a pretty unenviable dilemma, and wonder if Tim has a view. I think they were in a really difficult position, and I'm not sure it's the sight of Christians and Yazidis. Certainly that stirred the Something Must Be Done Brigade, of which we're all honourable members. But
I'm actually a member of the Sometimes Do Nothing Brigade, as well as Sometimes Do Something. But I agree with that last bit about damned if you do, damned if you don't. I've been in Syria 5 times in the last couple of years. There is no secular opposition. There is only shades of Islamist opposition.
Or, there was secular opposition.
There was at the beginning, absolutely at the beginning. But they've been pushed out of the way as the way they always are. Russian Revolution, Iranian Revolution, you know, the nice guys get pushed out of the way very quickly. And if they had armed the opposition, without any question, those weapons would have gone to ISIS, now Islamic State, because the biggest boys in town knock on their shoulder and say, excuse me, I want that. And are you going to say, no, you can't have it? No.
Now we're going to stop for 1 second to slip in a commercial break, which has come much later in the show. As you can gather, the conversation has been very lively, but we're going to be back in one short second.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me is Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor for Sky News, and Ivor Gaber, director of City University's Masters in Political Journalism. We're going to jump now to Ukraine, where officials said today that 280 trucks carrying humanitarian aid from Russia to Luhansk in eastern Ukraine won't be allowed to cross the border. Ivor, what is this narrative here? Because, you know, it's been so confused over the past couple of days. Even the government in Kiev doesn't quite know what's going on.
I think Mr. Putin knows what's going on, but he hasn't yet revealed it. I mean, one can take this at face value and say that there's clearly the people in the Russian population in East Ukraine, in Donetsk and Luhansk in particular, are suffering great privations, pictures on Russian television every night. And so he's mustered this force of 280, which is an awful lot of trucks, all looking surprisingly like Russian army trucks, all manned by people in civilian dress who look awfully like soldiers in civilian dress. Am I being cynical, or is there a plot going on? Certainly, I was surprised by the assertive statement, to put it mildest, of Secretary General of NATO Rasmussen, who said, look, you know, this looks like double dealing. And Laurent Fabius, the French foreign minister, said similarly. So I suspect they've got grounds for saying that. And the International Red Cross is very unhappy. The convoy, as I understand, has set off. The International Red Cross has said they've not approved it, and the Ukrainians have said, you know, obviously if the Red Cross don't approve it, we're not letting it in. I think this is storing up. I hate to think what's going to happen at the Ukrainian border.
Tim, when the story broke, you know, the Russians said it had the backing of the Red Cross and the government in Kiev.
No way.
Exactly. Now the
principal might have. I think they would have supported the principal.
Well, and there is a way through this, and that way is roll up to the border with all your trucks, transfer it to Red Cross trucks, allow the Red Cross to make sure that it's not full of machine guns. And the history of warfare tells us that it would be pretty surprising if in amongst the rice packets and all the rest of it, there wasn't arms. I mean, that's what normally happens. But in certain conflicts, not in all, I should hasten to add. And if the Red Cross find any, they can obviously get it out. But it's a question of sovereignty for the Ukrainians. Like, if Ukrainians can't just say, yes, 280 trucks from Russia can just drive into our country full of who knows what, there's no way they're going to allow it. So if Putin does mean what he says, he can get them to the border, they can be searched, they might even be allowed through as long as the Ukrainians have sovereignty over their border. Because that's the issue. Because it is about the people of Donetsk and Luhansk, but it's about a wider issue, and that is that who controls that part of Ukraine.
But don't allow the trucks through, and then the Russians will say, okay, you're starving Russians in Luhansk, yeah, and then we have the right to send in the military, surely.
But even if there aren't machine guns hidden in the rice, there is the issue of supplying the fighters with food and aid is something, even if it was only food and aid, the Ukrainian government would be extremely reluctant, understandably reluctant to do. So even if it is all just food...
It has to be a third party.
But Tim, don't you think that that's the kind of instance where if it was like the US supplying aid, you know, we would, you know, say it has to come across the border. So it's a bit... We have to be careful about what we argue here, don't you think?
Well, yeah, but actually, to connect this back to the previous subject... When the idea was to start perhaps arming rebels in Syria, that was going to come through Turkey, but it was going to stop at the border and they were going to take it across, at which point nobody would have any idea where it would end up other than that with the nastiest of the bad guys. And it's the same thing. It's an issue of sovereignty. And Ukraine is a modern industrialized country. It is not going to allow people to come through. I agree that some of the stuff from NATO has been interesting, to say the least. And I have yet to see any evidence of these 45,000 Russian troops allegedly massed on the border. I've been hearing about them for months and months and months. I've never seen any pictures of them. And we've got to remember, I mean, I'm not taking sides here, but there are two sides. They both want to control Ukraine. One is called West, or the EU and the United States, and have the influence there and pull it towards their sphere of influence. And one is called Russia, and they are both busy giving their versions of the story.
Well, I hate to stop it here, but I have to, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining me. That was Ivor Gaber and Tim Marshall, and I'm sure they'll be back soon on Monocle 24. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with our correspondent in Mali when we meet the actress who's taken on one of the theatre's most challenging roles. But before any of that, we're going to, in a moment, cut to Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines. But first, a short break.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, the time now is 18:31 here in London, and it's time for the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. The International Committee of the Red Cross said today it was waiting for clarification from Russia of what was loaded onto a convoy of trucks from Russia heading towards Ukraine. Russia says the convoy is carrying tons of humanitarian aid needed for eastern Ukraine. Israel says there's been little progress so far in talks to try to end the conflict in Gaza. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators are resuming separate talks in Egypt as the 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza holds for a second day. A Spanish priest who died after contracting the Ebola virus in Liberia has now been cremated in Spain, the first European death in the outbreak that's already claimed more than 1,000 lives. And the Vatican has called on Muslim religious leaders to condemn what it called unspeakable criminal acts by Islamic State militants who've taken a series of cities in northern Iraq, forcing tens of thousands of Christians and Yazidis to flee their homes. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. And the time now is 18:32 in Moscow, 6:32 in London, and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Mali, where our Bamako correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith, awaits. Hi, Alex. We're going to start with a story which is about Timbuktu and a bombing raid that the French carried out on Sunday. What do we know about this?
Well, it hasn't been officially confirmed, but it was carried out by the French Special Forces. They still have a small base in Timbuktu, and residents I've spoken to in the city were able to give me information about drones flying over the city, the western outskirts of the city, at the weekend. And then early on Sunday morning, four or five very large bombs were dropped. We understand that they were dropped on an area where the French and the United Nations, who are in Timbuktu, believe that an ACMI, an Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb cell, is operating. Indeed, there have been rocket attacks in recent times on Timbuktu Airport, and also a landmine that blew up, killing two Norwegian Refugee Council workers in their vehicle about 8 weeks ago.
Now, the other story that's affecting Timbuktu is that Google are taking an interest in the city.
Well, that's quite interesting. Yes, I was in Timbuktu about 2 weeks ago. I spent about a week there trying to get under the skin of the city and meeting ordinary people and trying to take an interest in something other than manuscripts and mosques, which is interesting because the insight you get is of a people who've lived through a lot of trauma, of course, with the Islamist occupation in 2012 and 13, and an economy that's really sealed off from the world because the areas all around Timbuktu are held by different rebel groups that are still fighting each other, and the economy within town is actually really at a standstill. So quite interestingly, on the plane back, there were three people from the Google Culture Institute, and even though I then tried to find out what they've got in mind for Timbuktu, the best I could do is more or less to overhear conversations, talk of a rock concert, to raise money for culture in Timbuktu, to digitalise the ancient manuscripts. There are manuscripts in Timbuktu going back to the 9th century, all of which aim to, I suppose, essentially put Timbuktu back on the map, or put it on the map, because a lot of people seem to think it doesn't exist, and perhaps also to run a little Google Earth vehicle round so that the whole world can see what the streets look like.
Alex, as you say, some people don't even believe it, think it's a mythical city almost. We know about it. But just give us a little bit of colour about what it's like to be there. You know, I've seen pictures, and we know that of all the things that were threatened to the manuscripts over recent years when different people kind of invaded the city. Is there kind of a normal for Timbuktu life going on now within the city?
Well, the problem for Timbuktu, I mean, normal, yes, in terms of the fact that, for example, the schools have gone back. Hospitals are operating thanks to international aid workers who are there. Because a very strong north-south divide exists in Mali, and Mali's a very centralized state, a lot of the public servants haven't actually returned since the city was liberated by the French in April last year. So that creates a problem when it comes to the clinics, when it comes to the schools, and when it comes to really getting the economy going. The banks are only just back, for example. The post office isn't really back. And then on top of that, you have this essentially garrison situation where all the surrounding areas are occupied by different rebel groups. So how does the city sort of breathe? You know, how does the economy function? Well, the economy functions through contraband, essentially. Most of the food that's sold in Timbuktu, and which isn't fresh food, comes from Algeria and Mauritania. Thousands of kilometres across the desert are travelled by 10-ton trucks carrying everything from spaghetti to powdered milk, subsidised food brought down by the mafias that control the economy of Timbuktu, sold very cheaply to people. So in other words, it's actually cheaper to buy Algerian spaghetti than it is to buy Malian spaghetti or even Malian sugar, because it's subsidised from the start and brought down by cartels who want to control the economy. So it's a very artificial economy, and it's an economy that's in great danger because it's so dependent on essentially an illegal economy.
And now, tell me, Ebola has been the Africa story that's been making the headlines over the recent days. What's happening in Mali? Is there a kind of a sense of nervousness that this could spread there?
Well, I mean, we had a suspected case that proved negative at the beginning of the outbreak in March. It's now having a second wave. A few days ago, the Senegalese authorities announced that a Malian had been put into isolation, having travelled through Mali to Senegal from Guinea, because Mali has a border with Guinea, which is one of the worst affected countries. But rather extraordinarily, or a bit worryingly, if you like, we have no confirmed cases in Mali. There is a high level alert. I mean, when you arrive at the airport, your temperature is taken, same at the land borders, but these are very, very porous borders. These are borders without very much control. A lot of people traveling crowded buses and minibuses across borders. A lot of people trade across the borders. So it does feel here in Bamako rather like it's only a matter of time before we have a case here.
and very little, I guess, that people can do to kind of prepare themselves. You know, is there a public service announcement telling people? I know in some countries they're telling people, you know, to be careful, you know, not to touch people, to wash their hands, to make sure their food is properly prepared. Are those messages being given out in Mali as well?
They are a bit. They were in March when the first wave of the of Ebola happened, and because it never materialised into a full-scale epidemic here, people are less vigilant, if you like, than they were in March. I remember just a few months ago, people were sort of saying, "Oh, I'd shake your hand, except I'd rather not." And you don't get that feeling now. I think people have rather sort of perhaps become a bit complacent because it didn't happen the first time around. But the public services messages are still there. It's just that I'm not sure people are taking them that seriously.
Well, Alex, thank you very much as ever for joining us. That was our Bamako correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith. Up next, we'll meet the mouth behind Samuel Beckett.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. My next guest is an actress whose current role ensures her body and face is never seen. Well, besides her mouth, that is. Samuel Beckett's classic dramatic monologue, Not I, written in 1972, features a single beam of light in a pitch black space. 8 feet above the stage are disembodied lips speaking rapidly in a stream of consciousness. Have a listen.
So no love, spared that, no love such as normally vented on the speechless infant in the home, no. Nor indeed, for that matter, any of any kind, no love of any kind at any subsequent stage. It's a typical affair, nothing of any note till coming up to 60 when, what, 70, good God, coming up to 70, wandering in a field, looking aimlessly for cowslips, to make a ball. A few steps then, stop, stare into space, then on a few more, stop and stare again, so on, drifting round when suddenly, gradually all went out. All that early April morning light and she found herself in the what? Who? No, she! Found herself in the dark, and if not exactly insentient, for she could still hear the buzzing so-called in the ears, and a ray of light came and went, such as the moon might cast.
Well, Lisa Duan, who you just heard there, is performing Not I as part of a one-hour trilogy, along with two other Beckett pieces, Footfalls and Rockaby, from Tuesday of next week through to Saturday the 30th at Queen Elizabeth Hall in London. And I'm delighted to say that Lisa joins me now. So, first of all, let's just... get our heads around how you do this, because you do it incredibly high speed. It's kind of a one take stamina festival. The power that you need to get through it. Tell us a little bit about the kind of the physical, you know, the challenges of doing it.
Yes, well, Becca wanted it spoken at the speed of thought. He wanted it to play on the nerves of the audience and not the intellect. So the speed helps bypass the intellect and play on the nerves of the audience. In order to achieve that, I obviously have to teach myself to speak really fast without taking a breath. So I don't think about it too much, but I believe I'm circular breathing. And I train my mouth and diaphragm to speak at this speed without moving out of the pinprick of light by tying my head into the banisters at home. Because in real life, the mouth hovers 8 foot above the stage, and I'm not 8 foot, I'm 5 foot. So the human mind doesn't attach it to a very tall person, and you get this disembodiment. The entire theatre is blackened out, including the exit signs, every leak of light, everything. It's the blackest space you'll ever enter. And when you see this, these disembodied lips on stage, an optical illusion is created, and the mouth appears, even though it's locked rigid, to float across the auditorium. I am, in fact, strapped into a head harness, two straps across my neck and my head, and my arms are placed into brackets so I don't move and I'm locked into a piece of wood. But the piece gives the impression that I'm floating about.
Now, Lisa, tell me, how long does it take you to from beginning to end of this? Now, I don't want to kind of see that as being the ultimate challenge of the piece, the speed at which you could do it. But as you said, it was important to Beckett. But I guess as the speed, but for the audience, it's the fact that when you listen to that clip even, the meaning still comes through, it's powerful. How do you balance the speed as well?
And the silences. Yes, I mean, the silences in Beckett are just as important. I guess a sort of deep intrinsic poeticism has to take control. And, you have to be sensitive to every aspect. I also have to make sure that each little phrase is understood. And my diction, from a technical point of view, I have to be very precise. It's a very difficult text to memorize. So the piece does summon a natural terror, which is very genuine every night. So that does provide a certain amount of momentum. And that terror is also an essential component to the overall piece. That terror is communicated through these lines on as well as the poetry and the...
No, you've also had a really interesting relationship with this play. This isn't the first time that you've done this. And it seems that it's a play that, or a monologue that kind of enchants people. It's famously also was done by Billy Whitelaw many times, who I believe you met as well. What is it about this that pulls you back again and again?
I don't think any writer has ever asked for so much. I don't even feel like a human being up there, let alone a woman. It's so expansive. The landscape is so vast. I don't hear just one linear stream of consciousness. I hear a cacophony of sentiments, of thoughts, of countries, of ideology, of opinions, of, I hear the nuns back home, Serbic parochial asides from Ireland. The piece is gargantuan in terms of its scope. And that is such a privilege as an actress to be asked for so much. It's so rare that we are, particularly being an actress. They describe it as the female Hamlet. It's incredibly challenging. I'm never on top of it. I have been performing it since 2005, but every time it's extraordinarily difficult. It takes everything I have, all of my concentration and emotional integrity as well.
Now, obviously, they get to see you in the other pieces, but when you're doing that and you're not seen and it is just your mouth... initially, when you did it, is there a kind of strange sensation of being both connected and incredibly disconnected from the people who are sitting in the audience?
One of the things that happens is that the disembodiment, I don't know, is it because of lack of circulation or something very easily explainable? I don't know. But I start to feel like I'm taking flight. And that's enormously expansive and exciting. I am conscious of the audience, as you're conscious of everything. You're in such a heightened state when you're in such terror, as well as, just the natural stage fright that any actress or actor will experience. You're so heightened, you feel everything. You notice every cough, every shift, every cough, every sneeze. You know, the dust, the very atmosphere in the auditorium, you are completely heightened. It's not as if you're going into some sort of navel gazing performance where you're not conscious of the audience. And the audience change the performance every night.
And tell me, when we go to the theatre so often these days, we're seeing kind of things which are, of course, easy to understand. They're entertainment. They're in the sometimes in the fluffiest form, and great too for that. But here we have something that challenges us a little. Do you, when audiences come to see Beckett, and whether Not I or the other pieces that you're doing, is it important that they come and take something away that kind of stays with them? It's like when you see Waiting for Godot, that. You kind of have an understanding when you're in the theatre, but there's something that lingers with you after you leave that may take days to kind of settle in your mind. Do you think that's important with Beckett?
Well, I think there's a misconception with Beckett that it's purely very intellectual. Beckett is almost parodying us here. or that notion. It's a very visceral and a highly emotional experience. You know, when I was rehearsing in Battersea Park during the summer of 2005, I rehearsed with a blindfold on. And when I lifted the blindfold, I'd collected an audience of park bench drunks who stood there gripping their cans of special brew or whatever. And they were an incredibly receptive audience who I feel got it immediately. My nieces, who are, you know, 7 and 12, totally understand this piece. I think there's simplicity and a complexity, but it's a very emotional connection. Beckett's late work in particular, it can be seen almost like chamber music. It is music, but, you know, to focus purely on the textual depth is to ignore the visual and the visceral experience as a whole.
And it's not just a pouring out of words. This is the story of a 70-year-old woman.
The narrative isn't that obscure. You know, what's happening, if anything, is a representation of thought. And it's all the interruptions and the music that comes out of that agony and pain.
And tell me, how come you've had such a long relationship with this play? Then 2005, as you say, is the first time you did it, this monologue. Why has it stayed with you, do you think, for so long? You know, your career changes, you age, but this play comes back to you again and again.
Yeah, I mean, I ask myself that a lot of the time, and I always return to Beckett because he, again, asks so much and offers so much. It's not all I do. I do a lot of other theatre, but it's hard.
It seems to slightly belong to you in some sense. It seems to be something that stays with you.
Well, the work is just so compulsive, and you never feel like your work is done. You never feel like you've ever arrived anywhere with it. You know, you just go deeper and deeper, and you keep discovering new things in the work. And also, it was such a privilege to have been coached by Billy Whitelaw to work with Walter Asmus. I just feel like I arrived at a time when we're looking at Beckett today. You know, my performance in comparison to Billy's performance are very, very different. In the 70s, it was very highly stylized. And I suppose I focus on making Beckett relevant today without making it banal.
And also wonderful that there was a one removed connection straight back to the man himself for you as well through those people. Lisa, thank you so much for coming to see us. That was the actress Lisa Dwan. And you can see Lisa perform Not I, Footfalls and Rockaby from the 19th of August to the 30th at Queen Elizabeth Hall in London.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And I'd just like to point out that if you just go and Google and do a little bit of search, you'll find that it goes on to many other towns around the UK. But it's time now to look at the world of music too. And joining us now from Monocle's New York Bureau is Gary Trust, who's the Associate Director of Charts and Radio for Billboard and also editor of Billboard's Chart Beat column. And he's going to take us through the subject of today's music. And we're going to start, first of all, welcome, Gary. And we're going to start with Sam Smith and Stay With Me. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, this is the number two song right now in the U.S. on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, right behind Magic, Rude. And, you know, what's interesting about this song is summertime music in the U.S. especially is usually party music. It's very up-tempo. And here's this song that's this really wrenching, emotional love song ballad, very down-tempo, that's become a really huge hit in the summertime. So I think that's really a testament to Sam's voice, to just how sincere the song is. So there's a good chance it's going to go to number one in the next couple weeks here in the U.S. It's, big in streaming, sales, airplay. It's completely taken over in the U.S.
Well, let's quickly just have a listen to that and hear some of that sincerity. Now, I believe, Gary, that Sam's a Brit, is that correct?
I believe that is correct, yes.
Well, no, I'm not claiming him for one of our own, but it's interesting that somebody who brings that kind of, you know, soulfulness to the American charts appeals to an American audience.
Yeah, and you know, it's actually, there's a trend going on. We just wrote about this. There's so many hits that are coming into the U.S. right now from other countries. The number one song I just mentioned, Rude by Magic, they're a Canadian reggae group. There's Nico and Vince with Am I Wrong? They're from Norway. Iggy Azalea from Down Under. So there's just been so many hits recently coming from abroad. And you know, I've talked to record people, some radio people about that. It's, we think it's a combination of, number one, just that's where the strongest music is coming from right now. Also, technology. It's not like in the old days where songs would need to build over months from around the world to make it to the U.S. with YouTube and streaming. It can take minutes. So I think that's a big part of it, along with just, the talent, which Sam Smith certainly has.
Now, tell us about this next one, because here's a trio that you might fear or be delighted that are joined in one group. Jessie J, Ariana Grande, and Nicki Minaj. Wow. Is this a good or a bad thing?
We'll let people listen. I'm in the good camp. All good with me.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to this, and then you can tell us a bit more about it. Okay, Gary, this is actually kind of, another Brit here, Jessie J. What do we make of this? Why has this been a hit, do you think, in the US?
Yeah, not exactly like Stay With Me, is it? A little bit different from Sam Smith. It's a fun party song. I mean, obviously, the first thing that's hitting everyone is, oh, wow, these three big acts, all women, got together.
One of them
so
very
there's an
big.
Event. Yeah, well, you know, in the
every
U.S.,
sense.
I'll just stick to the music.
Okay.
I'll keep it on that level. But it's got the star power, but, you know, that's not enough just to make a song a hit. There have been collaborations over the years by big acts that it all comes down to the song in the end. So this is a really, it's a fun song. It has kind of a 60s, 70s soul feel to it. Sounds like maybe something Tina Turner might have done years ago. So, you know, good song, a huge artist. It had a great debut a week here in the U.S. It sold 230,000 first week downloads, which is the second biggest sales week of the year for a first week song. So radio's all over it. I think it could be more than just a summer hit. I think it's, I was going to say it has legs to it, but I feel like you might make another joke if I say
no,
that.
I won't make any more jokes, but we'll have the choruses. The chorus is bang, bang into the room. I know you want it. Bang, bang,
right.
Bang, bang all over you. But we'll leave it there. Okay, one more. This is the final one. This is Meghan Trainor. This is a track that we are playing here on Monocle 24, a favourite of ours. This is all about that bass. We'll hear the track and then we'll jump over to you, Gary. Okay, Gary, tell us about Meghan.
Yeah, Meghan's is a really cool story. She's actually from the island of Nantucket in Massachusetts, off the coast. And I'm from Massachusetts, so right off the bat, I was like, oh, that's great. I sort of felt a kinship to it. But this is an interesting song. It's a mix of a lot of different styles, sort of like Bang Bang that we just heard. This one brings back some doo-wop, some Motown. A lot of that is Meghan's background. Her father is from Trinidad. She grew up with the genre known as soca music, which has a lot of tropical elements to it. And now she's living in Nashville, which is the home of country music. So she's got a lot of different styles about her. And this song just doesn't sound like anything else that's on radio right now because of all those different sounds. And lyrically, too, that's the other big catch. It's a positive body image song. She's bringing booty back, as she says. So there's just a lot of different hooks to this song. It's just really fun. It flew into the top 10 this past week on the Billboard Hot 100. So another huge hit and a little bit more surprising this one because, about a month ago, no one had even heard of Meghan.
Well, Gary, thank you for supporting one of your own, and thank you for coming on to Monocle 24. That was Gary Trust from Billboard, and that's all we have for today's Midori House. After the headlines, it's our weekly design show, Section D. But for me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye.
From London to Beijing,
this is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.